I'm very curious about everything, but I also think that sometimes we have to be careful about curiosity because we can be kicking hornets' nests just because we're interested, and sometimes that's not a good thing. This shows up a lot, particularly in the forensics community. Is your curiosity worth the amount of pain and suffering that you might cause this stakeholder community?
Hello, and welcome to The Vandal Theory, a podcast about science and research at the University of Idaho. I'm your host for the day, Danae Lenz, External Communications Coordinator for U of I, and I'm here today with my co-host. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Danae. My name's Lee Cooper, and I am the science writer and editor here at the University of Idaho.
Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not too bad.
Today we're going to talk about human remains, so I have a question to kick us off. Do you think the dead have power over the living, either literally or figuratively?
You know, what happens after death is anybody's guess, I suppose. But I do think the dead have power over us in terms of how we think about them. I mean, probably everybody listening to this has lost somebody. You know, it sticks with you as to, you know, what their last moments were like. Were they at peace? Were they suffering? Did we do everything we could for them? Or did we maybe keep them too long? Did we force them to stay too long? I think those types of questions, you know, stay with people who lose people. They're questions that obviously we will never have the answer to, but, you know, death is so unknown. We want to understand as much as possible, and we want a good death for people. We want people to be at peace when they pass. And so I think those questions, you know, always linger for people who have lost others.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's a very complicated issue. But today we're going to talk to someone who's thought about it a lot. Kate Colpan is an assistant professor of anthropology whose research includes a focus on warfare and the recovery, identification, and commemoration of human remains. She's going to discuss the politics behind recovering bodies, the power dead people hold over the living, and how forensic anthropology differs from how it's depicted on TV. Hello, Kate. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Danae. Thanks for having me.
You have lots of stories and I'm eager to get to them, but why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Okay, hello. My name is Kate Colpan. I am an assistant professor at the University of Idaho, and I am both a bioarchaeologist and a forensic anthropologist. A bioarchaeologist is someone who studies material culture from the aspect of looking at actual human remains, and usually from contexts that are far more in the past than a forensic anthropologist. A forensic anthropologist is someone who works within the medical legal system, dealing with human remains that are usually from either the last 50 to 75 years, things where they would be medical legally significant. And in that case, you can be looking at single body from a medical examiner or coroner's office. You might be looking at multiple bodies from people who were the victims of massacres or genocidal activities. And so it really depends upon the situation and the context.
So your work has taken you all over the world. Excavating human remains seems like a situation that could be fraught with conflict, or at least you might get caught in the middle of someone else's agenda. How do you handle the politics around that aspect of your job?
A lot of what I do isn't political, right? There are a lot of things that don't require this, but there is always the possibility, particularly because I've dealt with remains that are in modern historical contexts. So things like the Second World War, for example, where a lot of emotion is wrapped up in those remains, particularly because they're unidentified. And so what I normally do, and I think bioarchaeologists or forensics people would see this as part of their due diligence, is I normally look into, like, where are the political pitfalls, right? The potential political pitfalls of what I'm doing. Is this being manipulated in some way? Because I won't do it if I feel like it is. And I think most people are genuine in sort of where they're going with something if they want to do identifications. But there's always the possibility of that not being so. I do a lot of background research, right? Pretty much everyone who does this kind of work does a lot of background research to make sure that they sort of know what the politics of what they're getting into is, because it's incredibly dangerous not to. And also, I don't want my work to be manipulated by people who have political or ideological agendas as much as I can control that, right? There are possibilities where I can't control how my work is going to be used. But I do think it is the responsibility of the person doing these kinds of excavations or ideas to figure out if there is a political agenda and what it is to the best of their abilities, and to work toward making sure that they're not being used in a way that is political, if possible.
Could you give an example of something in your work where something like that came up?
I mean, I worked for my PhD work in post-conflict Bosnia. You know, a lot of people ask me about it and they sort of treat it as if the war is still going on. And war there is not going on. It's not an active conflict zone. But I was looking at World War II remains that they're very personal to a lot of people. And a lot of those remains weren't ID'd after the war. And unfortunately, in that part of the world, in the former Yugoslavia, the ethnic and religious communities there didn't all fight on the same side of the war. And during the late 80s and early 90s, and there are quite a lot of people who've written about this, there were people on different sides of that conflict who used those remains as a way to indicate that other people, like other religious or ethnic communities, were barbarous or monstrous or, you know, deserving of ethnic cleansing or genocide. And so anytime you do those kinds of ideas, there's always the potential that, you know, somebody who has very, very nationalistic tendencies is going to use what you uncover as a way to sort of foment support for whatever kind of agenda they have, just because people in this area of the world, they have very long memories. They remember all of these things. And it's also a very hard conflict to deal with because socialism didn't allow for a lot of discussion, or sometimes any discussion, of what had happened to people's communities during the war. And in certain cases, those aspects are really fraught, right? So like you have instances where people are recording that people in their community were thrown down ravines alive and just left to die, or that they were put in a church and the church was set on fire. And that's a really hard thing to grapple with. Or that everyone in your village was rounded up and shot. And that can be really, really difficult to deal with if you, A, know what happened, and then B, have no outlet for it. And so there's always the possibility that you're dealing with people who were part of this really serious conflict in the 40s, that then shows up again in the late 80s, early 90s, when you get these referenda on what are we going to do since former Yugoslavia has broken up and we were a bunch of republics and now we're going to become separate countries, but we're not homogenous, right? We're not a homogenous group of people. We're ethnically and religiously different from each other. And in Bosnia in particular, there were a lot of people who weren't from a majority community. And so it's really easy, right? Dead people are worth, you know, 1,000 words like pictures. And it's really easy when you have a lot of dead people who have clear evidence of traumatic injury or, you know, clear evidence that they were involved in the war in some way, a way to use that to make an argument for a particular political position. And that's not unique to any particular group. That happened across the board.
So sort of related, but many people in the U.S. think of human remains differently than how they're thought of abroad and among other ethnic groups. Can you talk a little bit about those differences?
Sure. I mean, there are differences in sort of how people cosmologically think about dead people. Dead people are very important to living people. Dead people are important to themselves too, but they're very important to living people. I mean, even thinking about modern context, just for, you know, your average everyday American, people have ideas about how they want to be buried and how they want to die and what is a good death. So you try to follow whatever practices those are. And sometimes cosmologically in the Americas, they're very different. And even in different parts of North America versus Central or South America, they might be really, really different in terms of how people conceive of the dead and what is appropriate to do with dead people. And that might be very different abroad. And so the trick with sort of dealing with this is if you have stakeholder communities you work with, ask them what they want. Don't assume that every single community is a monolith, right? Ask them what they would like done. If they don't want anything done, right? If they don't want to deal with bioarchaeologists or archaeologists at all, leave them alone. If they have particular ideas about what they would like done archaeologically, work with them. And so it really depends upon the situation. So like my collaborators are abroad. They don't have the same cosmological notions as, for example, Indigenous communities in the United States do. And even then, Indigenous communities in the U.S. are not a monolithic community, right? They have a lot of different ideas. And so the trick is ask them what they want. Talk to them. Figure out what it is they would like to have done, if anything. And if they don't want to have anything done, don't do anything.
You've said before that the dead have power over the living. What do you mean by that?
Okay. When we talk about things like haunting, for example, or anything of like power dynamics, right? Like this is basically like the beginning of every horror movie involving ghosts ever, is this idea that people can get stuck in liminal spaces, right? They can get stuck between being dead and being alive. And they can also haunt you, the living person, until you figure out what it is they either need or want. And so there's a possibility, particularly with improper burial, that these people will walk the earth forever. They will never be at rest. Or they will haunt you specifically until you figure out what it is they want. There's also just the possibility with dead people and their relationships to living people that living people just really care about dead people, right? We care about our ancestors. We care about, you know, you care about your mother or your grandmother or whatever, and you want to give that person whatever it is they want. And so, yeah, there's a power dynamic there where you're trying to make sure that you have acknowledged them and their importance, and then also gone about doing things in the way that they would have wished to, right? That's why people leave wills, for example. We are constantly having discussions about what do you want to have done after you die? How do you want your funeral? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be buried? What goes on the headstone? Where does that headstone go? So all of that is the power dynamic, even if we don't think of it as such. And we are, as living people, in a lot of cases, very concerned that we will either upset dead people or that they will have some sort of control or power over us after we die. Or after they die. Sorry, we're still alive.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You had kind of touched on it, but you've done some work identifying the remains of people who died in World War II fighting for the Axis powers. They weren't necessarily Nazis themselves, but they were fighting for that side of the war. What's it like for you to work on a project like that?
I mean, it's difficult. I've definitely had a lot of people ask me about this, and it's always sort of framed as like, but aren't you like helping identify dead Nazis? And let me be very clear, I'm not being an apologist for anything. There are only about 25% of people who fought for the Reich during the war were actually in the party, right? A lot of them were conscripts or children who'd been brainwashed. And so this is a very strange idea. I'm not suggesting that there's anything good about fighting for the Third Reich. I don't think there is. But I sort of see it as we don't know who these people are. There might be people who are looking for them. They've been gone for 80 years. And there's a lot to sort of tease out about people who are incredibly problematic, right? These are incredibly problematic people. Their position in a place that basically, you know, sort of thinks about its very large resistance movement. Yugoslavia was a pretty terrible place to be during the war. It's 4 years of guerrilla warfare. You have two different kinds of resistance movements. One is monarchist, it's a Czech movement, and one is a communist socialist movement. And they spent 4 years just enacting guerrilla warfare on these soldiers who either got conscripted for the Reich or volunteered for the Reich. And Hitler had sort of come in and been like, well, this is going to be easy. And it was originally, right? It takes them 2 weeks to subdue Yugoslavia after the coup. And then they spent 4 years involved in this really awful guerrilla war with all of these guerrilla groups who know the terrain way better than they do. Bosnia is very, very mountainous. And they just, I mean, I'm going to be very candid, in a lot of cases, just kick the crap out of them. And so it gets very heated, but you have a lot of people who are sort of fighting on different sides of the war, but who are from the same country. They live in the same kingdom. And so this is sort of more what that's about for me than thinking about it in terms of, like, why should we ID these people who are, you know, sort of on the wrong side of history? The whole thing's really complicated, right? It's incredibly complicated. And I never, ever want to see myself be used as some sort of apologist, particularly because of my own family's history, with the war as some sort of apologist for, you know, Nazi ideology, because I find it abhorrent. So it is hard. My dad asked me about it, too. It was a question he asked me, too. He was like, how do you reconcile this? And I talked with the Holocaust scholar I work with for my PhD on it, too. And he said, you know, a lot of the people who study the Holocaust, right, who study the sort of perpetration of the Holocaust, are people who would have been exterminated because they don't understand how anyone could do this. And that's sort of where I fall out. I'm in a group of people who would have been exterminated by the Reich, and I don't understand why they could do what they did. And so that's sort of where I'm falling out on this. I mean, I'm very curious about everything, but I also think that sometimes we have to be careful about curiosity, because we can be kicking hornets' nests just because we're interested. And sometimes that's not a good thing. And this shows up a lot, particularly in the forensics community. Is your curiosity worth the amount of pain and suffering that you might cause this stakeholder community? Do these people actually want what you are offering them? And if they don't, you're going to, even if you feel like you have the moral high ground, or there's some sort of political mandate or ethical dilemma about identifying people, if you're going to hurt the people that this is supposedly going to help, even if you have legal authority, maybe it's not worth doing. Or maybe you have to really, really think about why you're doing what you're doing. Because your curiosity isn't more important than the amount of pain you're going to cause them.
Okay, let's pivot to the forensic anthropology side of your job. How is real life forensics different from how it's depicted on TV?
I mean, honestly, it's a lot more tedious. I feel like every single time you see like Bones on TV, right? She's wandering around with the FBI, and that's really cool and it's really interesting and it makes for good television. But honestly, a lot of what we do would just be really boring TV, right? It's sort of like, you know, no, cop shows don't spend a lot of time with like cops sitting around filling out paperwork, which is a lot of their job, because it's not interesting to watch. And so the reality is, a lot of what forensics is, you know, sitting there with a skeleton, trying to tease out who this person is, sometimes looking at drama. I feel like also that's the other thing, is that TV shows make it seem like everything is always a homicide and it's always trauma. Like, it's always like an unknown suicide or a homicide, and there's always trauma. And in a lot of cases, with anthropological analysis, most of what you're doing is an identification. Who is this unknown person? Because they've, you know, died in their house and they've been there for 2 months and no one has found them, so they've decayed. Or they went out in the woods for a hike and nobody found them for 6 months, and so there's no flesh on them. In both of those cases, those are either accidental or natural deaths, and there is no evidence of foul play there, right? There's no catching of bad guys. What it is more so is, this person belongs to people. Someone is missing this person and looking for them potentially, and how do we help law enforcement agencies or the medical legal establishment figure out who this person is so they can be returned to those people, right? So a lot of what you're doing is just looking at like the age, sex, ancestry, which is a problematic category, and stature of that person, in addition to like anything idiosyncratic about that skeleton. Do they have supernumerary teeth, which just means, do they have extra teeth in their mouth? Do they have weird healed fractures that you might be able to compare with an antemortem radiograph? So a radiograph, like an x-ray that was taken during the person's lifetime to see if they're the same. Do they have weird pathological condition? Did they have some sort of chronic disease or illness that impacted their skeleton in some way? Do they have a hip replacement? If they have some sort of hip replacement or something like that, something that has a serial number, that's gold, because we know who that person is then. All of those are things that help identify that person. So you're writing a report for that. And then if there is trauma, you obviously include the trauma. I can't make any kind of designation. No forensic anthropologist can make any designation on cause of death. We're not medical doctors. We can help you by saying like, oh, there are several like concentric fractures and they're fresh, they're not healed, and so this might have contributed to this person's death. But the reality is that cause of death, yeah, there might be 50 stab wounds on this person and I can see them all over their ribs, but the thing that killed them might be blood loss, right? And so exsanguination. Exsanguination's not the same thing. And I'm not a medical doctor. I can't make that determination. And so I'm really there in a support capacity, right? Every forensic anthropologist who works is there in a support capacity to try and figure out who this person is. And if there is evidence of trauma, indicate where that evidence of trauma is, and what we think might have caused this, but not in any way that's super, super definitive, because a lot of the time we don't know, right? I can't say this is this particular screwdriver, for example. And TV makes all of it seem like it's so effortless instead of like being tedious in a lot of cases, right? Where you're putting small pieces back together, right? Particularly like fire cases, because you have lots of little pieces. Or, you know, unless you really like it, probably boring for a lot of people. Gross sometimes, right? Particularly if their remains are greasy. So like think about like the greasiest chicken you've ever eaten. Not to be very graphic, or if there's still adhering flesh on them that you have to take off. So it requires a certain kind of sort of mental capacity and way of thinking about things to be able to do it. If you like faint at the sight of blood, probably not the right job for you. And the other part is like when you watch Bones, there are all kinds of technologies that just don't exist. Like the Angelotron or Angelator, like she gets called different names throughout the show. That can create an entire holographic image of a living person in like 7 minutes. It's impossible. It doesn't exist. You can't do it. And it also makes people who do reconstruction, which is really hard. It's so hard to do a reconstruction of what a living person looks like from a skull or any kind of skeletal material. It trivializes what they do. It makes it look super easy. I'm looking at that and I'm going, that woman is doing this in like 7 minutes and that's like four people's jobs. And it's so hard to do. So I think it makes our jobs look simultaneously harder and easier at the same time. I want people to be entertained. And the reality is that shows like Bones were helpful for forensic anthropology. They let people know what we do. It's really hard to explain what you do a lot of the time unless you can visually show people that. And a lot of the time they really wouldn't want to see that. And it was also just good for student engagement, right? Mm-hmm. Even now, when I teach forensics, I will ask, who here has ever watched those kinds of shows? And like at least half the class's hands will go up. So if it creates student engagement, I'm all for that, right? I'm in favor of anything that gets them in the classroom engaged in what it is I'm doing.
Sort of related to what you just said, but I know many of your students have had opportunities to go out into the field with you. Why is it important to you that your students get their hands dirty?
Whether it's bioarchaeological or forensic anthropology related, I think that there are a couple of reasons that it's important to be in the field. One, there are so many students who like it way more than they thought they would, which is always nice. One of my students who I'm close with, who hates bugs and dirt and being dirty, she and I just had a conversation where she was like, I loved it so much. I loved it way more than I thought it was. So now I feel like I could actually be in the field. Like I could actually do field work. Before I was like, I don't know, I'm going to be an archivist or work in a lab because I hate being dirty and I hate dirt. And now she knows that that's not true, right? She can actually do this. And then the opposite also happens. You have students who go in the field who realize they hate everything about it. And it's better to learn that early on then get on later on your career, be stuck doing things that you really don't like when you could actually do something in the field that makes more sense to you, right? Maybe you want to be in a laboratory all the time. Maybe you want to work in a repository or a museum. It's better to learn that earlier. The biggest reason really is there are many, many situations where you really can't learn how to do this unless you're in the field. Right? So many things happen during fieldwork, during experiential learning, that you can't get sitting in a classroom listening to me like either tell funny stories or talk about this. There's only so much book learning will teach you. And that can be really good or really, really bad, right? But like even just like getting the opportunity to like be in a lab and, you know, have to work on, you know, defleshing, macerating the body of a dead person. There are people who think they will be okay with that, try to do it, realize, no, this is not okay for me. And then there are other people who think that like, okay, I'll be okay, or I'm a little apprehensive, and they're fine. But that's the reality of the job in a lot of cases. And so you have to be okay with that. There's also a very big difference between learning about a skeleton and touching a skeleton. I fully understand people who find that really uncomfortable or upsetting or something they just don't ever want to do. I completely understand that. But it's really hard to do bioarchaeological or forensics work which is entirely based upon skeletal material, without doing that. And so being in the field is really, really important. It also just teaches you practical skills. There's so many practical skills you have to learn by doing them over and over again. Just like how to dig a hole, right? There's a correct way to dig a hole. There's a correct way to work around and move a skeleton, all of which you have to learn by doing it over and over and over again, right? I'm still learning. I learn all the time. I learn from being out in the field with people who know more than I do. I learn from my students too. They ask questions in the field for things where I'm like, oh, I've never really considered this. Like, huh, I've never thought about this thing. We just do it because we do it, right? It's like trying to teach people a math problem when you're like, no, but this is just how things are done. And you're like, oh, no, I have to be better at explaining why you do this thing. Or like, I have to have a better answer for the thing that I just think seems obvious.
What would you most want people to take away from this conversation about your work or whatever?
I think one is be respectful of the dead, right? Be respectful of the dead. Try to work and meet people where they are and recognize that this is a very fraught subject, right? That this is a very fraught subject. There's not a lot of, sometimes there's a right answer, but a lot of the time there's a lot of multiple ways of thinking about dead people and working with dead people and being respectful of other people's conceptions of dead people. And then the other thing I think is TV isn't real life. Television is not reality. All of forensics work is much more tedious and harder to do and takes a lot more work and effort and also takes a lot more time, right? DNA on TV always seems to come back within 50 minutes, where the reality is it can take you months to get a DNA sample just because DNA labs are so backed up. Those people are very good at their jobs, but there's only so many of them. And so I think those are sort of the things that, you know, I want people to take away. And also, like, if this is something that you think you're interested in, get involved. Contact people. Talk to people about what they do. We love new students, right? We love people getting involved with what we do. Do some hands-on things.
That's great. Okay, well, I think that's it. Thank you so much for your time today.
Sure, no problem. It was a fun conversation.
Okay, Lee, what did you think?
Oh, goodness, that was so much more complex than I was imagining. So, I mean, I've watched Bones. I've watched CSI. I've even read the books that Bones are based on. And at no point did I ever think to myself, oh, should you be doing this? Should you be identifying these people? How is this going to be used? That was so much more fraught with political problems than I ever thought about. And I could see that being true to life. You look at some of the conflicts that have happened in the world over the last couple of years, and my goodness, I mean, yeah, you could see one side using, you know, past atrocities to excuse new atrocities. And yeah, I never looked at it in such a complicated way, and I appreciate that she brought that to the table and kind of shone a light on how, yes, this can be used for good to bring closure and peace to people, but it also, if, you know, as an anthropologist, you're not careful, that information could be used not to better society, but to make it worse.
Right. I really appreciated her insight on that because that's something I never would have thought of before.
Yeah, never thought of that. Goodness.
I think the part that stuck with me most, as someone who is a very curious person, is that curiosity can sometimes be super harmful. And so we need to kind of check ourselves before we just dive into something, especially something that affects other people.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that at all either. That's an excellent point.
All right, everyone, thanks for listening to The Vandal Theory. You can visit our website at uidaho.edu/vandaltheory for more about our research. Email us at vandaltheory@uidaho.edu. We're on all the podcast platforms, so rate and review and subscribe. I'm Danae Lenz.
And I'm Lee Cooper.
Thanks for joining us.